Hey, it's Shauna Meyerson with Yoga Athletica in Los Angeles, California. Joined today by retired Major Andrew Fox, who was with the British military. But for anybody who does not know, Andrew is now a researcher on military, and we're going to be talking today particularly about war crimes, disproportionality, and all the other good words that have been flying about. So before we begin, let me just ask a question of the viewers, which is that when I say 41,000, what do you think of? Okay, my guess is that when you think of that number, you think of the number of civilian casualties in Gaza. And I bet the words disproportional force or something like that come to mind as well. Oh, and now Lebanon. Am I right? I mean, that number, 41,000, is pounded into our heads. It's plastered all over the news and social media, and it's so much bigger than, say, 1,200. So it must be right, right? And Israel must be wrong. Wrong. Let's be clear that the number 41,000 comes from the Gaza Health Ministry. Sounds super official, I know. Well, it's Hamas. The world is relying on a designated terrorist organization for its facts. And the war casualty numbers are not only just made up, but they also include everyone who has died in Gaza since 10/7, meaning targeted Hamas terrorists, of which are about 17,000. People who die of old age, sickness, car accidents, normal dying things. And yes, from the massive number of misfired Hamas and other terrorist rockets too. Approximately 10 to 20% of all the missiles they fire. Don't believe me that the numbers are made up. Show me one other war ever that doesn't involve Israel, okay, that's an important caveat, that has real-time statistics on civilian casualties. Typically, it takes like a year or more for a war-torn nation to enumerate its dead. There's that. On top of that, Hamas has publicly stated on many occasions that they welcome civilian death as it brings them sympathy to their cause. Human shields, anyone? On top of that, name one other war ever that doesn't involve Israel where the news reports civilian casualties at all, much less in every story, every day. They don't do that with Russia and Ukraine, and they didn't do it in Afghanistan or Iraq or, well, anywhere. Double standards like this that apply only to the Jewish state are anti Semitic. Never mind that they're counterfactual as well. But don't take my word for it. Today, I am honored to be joined by retired Major Andrew Fox, who is an expert analyst of the Middle East, defense, and disinformation. Andrew Fox served for 16 years in the British Army, leaving as a major in the Parachute Regiment. He deployed on three tours in Afghanistan, including one attached to U.S. Army Special Forces. He was then a senior lecturer in the War Studies and Behavioral Science departments at the Sandhurst. I love that you always qualify this as the UK equivalent of West Point. And he's currently a research fellow at the Henry Jackson Society, a Westminster political think tank. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. The last week and last 2 weeks have been crazy, and I know you have just been so overwhelmed with commitment. So thank you so much for joining me.
No, it's my pleasure. I'm sorry that we had to bounce this around a couple of times. It's just been, as you know, an insane week. I was at the United Nations, talking there, and just before that, I was in France, and just before that, I was in Israel. So it's been a fairly busy week, as well as trying to keep on top of everything that's going on in the Middle East at the moment, which is no mean feat as things develop minute by minute, never mind day by day.
Changing by the day. Exactly. Don't worry. When it comes to the like hierarchy of like speaking at the UN and speaking to Shauna Meyerson, yoga instructor in Los Angeles, I give you the pass on that one. You're the one doing me the favor. So I'm going to start in maybe an unconventional place, mostly because I'm from America. I have a worldwide audience, but I tend to speak in frames of American. I've spoken to a lot of American guests. So I want to get into a little bit about the UK and its relationship with Israel. So the US-Israel relationship, for anybody who doesn't know, was basically formed when the USA was literally the first nation in the United Nations to recognize the State of Israel in 1948. It could probably best be encapsulated as shared values, morality, and over time, a lot of shared strategic interests. The history of British-Israel relationships is much more complex, as before Israel was founded, the land fell under the jurisdiction of the British Mandate of Palestine. And through like the Balfour Declaration, San Remo Conference, the Peel Commission, and finally the UN Partition Plan, Israel was born. And Britain really had sort of an unofficial boycott of the Jewish state all the way up until the first official royal visit in 2018. So, Andrew, can you tell me a little bit about UK-Israel relations and also how this history sort of colors relations today?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. And there was definite conflict between the British as they were overseeing Mandatory Palestine and various groups from both sides who were conducting terrorist acts to achieve their political end states. So I think there's always been a sort of lingering resentment. The most famous one of those being the King David Hotel bombing. So it's been a tricky one right from the inception. And as you say, we've been famous abstainers in the UN on issues of Israel for decades now. And that seems to have continued. We're more pro-Israel when there's a conservative government in. We definitely tack anti-Israel when there's a Labour government in. And of course, there's been a Labour government in since 2 months ago now.
Sure.
And in that time, we've seen UNRWA refunded. We've seen endless calls for a ceasefire immediately, essentially telling Israel to lay down their arms. Because that's what we really mean when we're talking about demanding a ceasefire, is Israel stopping. I think nobody is calling on Hamas for a ceasefire, are they? It's always Israel that are they're in the firing line for that.
Is it
So,
only
go on.
Israel is legitimate and worth talking to, or is it literally because they honestly, in some way, believe that this is upon Israel?
Yeah, I think it's partly the latter. I do. I think they genuinely think that this is a war of aggression on Israel's part, and they've gone in far harder on Gaza than they need to have done. Have caused far more destruction than they needed to do. I think that's the dominant narrative on that side of the argument. There's so many comments even today saying, why couldn't Israel do in Gaza what they've done in Lebanon? And I think it just points to a real failure to understand this situation in any real depth.
Of course. And it's funny because it had it not been for the hostages, honestly, Gaza probably could have been ended in 2 weeks. Because Israel cares about rules of war, and I want to get into that. If Israel did not care about rules of war, Gaza could have been done in an hour. But that's not how Israel operates. And also, I just want to add, like, as a Jewish person, even across the pond, the world Jewish community has feared the return of labor to power in Great Britain for obvious reasons. Jeremy Corbyn is not only a rabid anti-Semite, but even a lot of Jews have left the Labor Party as a result. And we're sort of seeing that with like this Jaxidus from the Democratic Party here in America. But I think that Jews are really caught between a rock and a hard place because we share all Western values, and as does Israel. But at the same time, we're sort of not being welcomed to the table. Now, Starmer, if I understand it correctly, is actually married to a Jewish woman. It's a little weird. David Lammy, that's another story.
Well, there's a really interesting piece here because actually the Starmer Labour Party managed to persuade a lot of British Jews back to Labour I think, does that mean there's only 100,000 Jews in the UK? It's a tiny, tiny figure compared to the United States. And they're mainly in sort of a few geographical areas in the country rather than spread out across as they are in America. And there has been a very, very strong traditional Labour Party Jewish voter base, and I think they believed Starmer when he said he'd done what he needed to do. The Jewish wife thing, I think she's secular Jewish rather than practicing Jewish. I think that duped a lot of people because the second Labour took power, they've been as anti-Israel, almost as anti-Israel as a Corbyn government would have been. There's very little between them. They haven't completely stopped arms sales, but they have curtailed some arms sales. They haven't yet recognised the state of Palestine, which I think Corbyn would have done immediately. But those two things aside, I don't think there's much more than a cigarette paper between what Starmer's government's doing and what Corbyn's would do in the same situation.
Sure. And even the arms embargo, I mean, isn't it largely performative? I mean, Israel does not get most of its arms from Great Britain. So same with Canada. Canada did the same thing. And of course, they're under the monarchy, and maybe I have no idea if there's any association there, but it's like they're going out of their way to try to undermine Israel at every turn.
I think from Labour's point of view, particularly, it's because five members of Parliament in the recent election took seats off Labour on a single issue ticket. It was a single issue pro-Gaza ticket. And I think that has Labour slightly spooked. And so they're engaging in a number of performative measures, including Starmer's speech in the UN this week, in order to try and reassure that Muslim voter base who've abandoned them at the last general election. So I think there's domestic politics at play here. I can't speak for Canada. I'm not really an expert on Canada. I don't think the royal family has much say in the matter. So I'd put your mind at ease on that one. I don't think King Charles is making phone calls to Trudeau to tell him to go against Israel. But certainly on the UK side, it's heavily domestic. And I think we are seeing shadows of that in America as well, where obviously there are key Muslim electorates in very, very important swing states that Kamala Harris is trying to shore up with some of her rhetoric. I do think America has been a pretty good ally for Israel throughout this conflict. You know, there's that they've done a lot in terms of mutual defense, pushing carrier groups to make sure Iran don't escalate. I think there are two carrier groups and a nuclear submarine in the region at the moment, which is unprecedented. And likewise, the US military has been pretty well embedded with the IDF throughout this process. There's lots of American uniforms lurking in the background in IDF headquarters. So, you know, I think the political rhetoric hasn't been great from Biden and Harris. The actions on the ground from America have actually been pretty strongly in favor of Israel in this conflict.
Sure. And I, if it weren't an election year, if this happened in 2021, I actually do believe I've been heavily involved in the pro-Israel community for about two decades and lightly involved before that. And Biden has always been there with us. I do believe that when he says he's a Zionist, that he actually is. I mean, how do you think all this would have unfolded in 2021 versus today?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's always tough doing crystal ball gazing. It's
Yeah.
and as an analyst, you know you're going out on a limb when you do a crystal ball gaze, because when you can analyze stuff that's already happened, it's easy. When you try and predict the future, or in this case the past, that's much harder. But yes, I think the rhetoric would have been a lot stronger. I think potentially we'd have seen possibly even more of a crackdown on some of the protests that we've had. And I've spoken to Jewish students. I spoke at the Israel on Campus Coalition a few months ago, and I heard firsthand that the horror stories from American college students that they're facing on campuses. And I spoke at Purdue University a while ago, with my Indiana connections right there. And yeah, it's horrible. And I'd like to think that in a non-election year, they could be a little bit more robust with things like that, because it's clearly not acceptable to have that level of anti-Semitism just nakedly worn on the streets.
Yeah, and I do wonder what's going to happen after the election, regardless of who wins, and in the lame duck period as well. If in theory, let's say Trump wins and there's a lame duck period, and Biden's hands aren't being held by anything, and Harris would not have the next administration, if there would be any sort of a pivot. I mean,
Yeah,
labor hasn't pivoted. They got their votes, and they're still. I mean, actually, I have a weird question because I would say that America humiliated Britain a lot more than Israel did when America was founded. But Britain managed to get over it. Do you? I mean, it's been since 48. I mean, what, almost 80 years. Like, is Britain ever going to get over this? Will they ever just accept the Jewish state? Do you think it's based in anti-Semitism? I mean, is it resentment? Is it like, why do you think this? I mean, because I would say that Britain shares American values, and America definitely shares Israeli values. It seems like a natural triumvirate, but that's definitely broken down.
Yeah, it's a really strange one. I think there's certainly a strain of anti-Semitism. It's that weirdly in sort of the upper middle class, there's a really strange sort of anti-Jewish kind of I don't know what you call it, like a cultural memory almost, where some of those cliches and tropes are handed down through generations, and our civil service can be quite populated by people like that as well. We've also, we have actively tried to campaign for Foreign Office recruiting from ethnic minorities, who of course come with potentially a bit of an anti-Israel bias.
Right.
But I think, we have to look at the effect of 60 years of information operations. I think this goes back to Yasser Arafat in 1964. It goes back to his Soviet backing and the way the Soviet Union played a very hardball information operations game with the sympathetic Western left, which I don't think you ever really had in America. So that could be a reason for it as well. But yeah, there's definitely a strain of anti-Israelism here as well. And also, actually, I think, the Prime Minister of Israel, Mr. Netanyahu, is a challenging man to get on with. If you're of the left, he's very much of the right. And I think instinctively for Biden and certainly for the Labour government, politically, they have very, very little in common with the current government in Israel, and that creates friction of its own.
I mean, the funny thing is that I mean, you've been to Israel, if I understand, 3 times since 10/7, correct? And I do want to get into, some of what you learned while you were there. But I'm sure you know that the Israeli right does not even consider Netanyahu to be right. He's very, very centrist. I mean, I think that we have to shift our frame of reference. What's right in a country such as, Great Britain or the United States, where we don't have to worry about being wiped off the face of the planet every single day, the right has a very different ramification than it does when you're Israel in the toughest neighborhood and 500 miles in every way, you've got enemies who wish to annihilate you. And so, right and left, I don't even think apply.
Yeah, and I generally stay clear of Israeli domestic politics because it's not really any of my business, and it's so insane
It's messy.
that it's really hard to keep track of. And actually, just as I don't really comment on American politics particularly, because again, that's not my business either. I generally stay clear of the Israeli stuff because that's for the Israeli electorate, not for random British guys to talk about.
Yeah, the coalition co government system, I think, needs to be reformed because it makes these really strange bedfellows that really can't create a coherent and effective policy for a nation that really needs like one path. Okay, so let me just ask one more question on sort of UK to frame this, and then I want to go into the more specifics of war crimes in the United Nations and the ICC. So obviously, I'm sure you've been asked this a million billion times. If the 10/7 massacre had come from Wales, how would Britain have responded differently?
Well, I can speak for my people in Wales and say that that definitely wouldn't have happened. I grew up in Wales and my father's
Okay,
Welsh, so
Scotland.
the Scots, that's entirely believable. That's an entire possibility from the Scots for it. Awful. Yeah, I mean, I don't think any country in the world would respond differently to how Israel has. I genuinely don't. And it sounds trite and it sounds cliched, but how can any country be expected to live with 60,000 of their people displaced from the north, and 150, was it 251 taken hostage, and then a further 1,000 massacred in a day? I think any country in the world would have done that. And if you look at, if Mexico had done that to America, which is probably a more fair than blaming the poor Scottish.
Sure.
I think we'd see Mexico City in ruins right now, in a far less restrained way than
And
Israel has done.
if we wanted to create an apt analogy, Canada would have jumped in also with 9,000 missiles at the same the day after, i.e. Lebanon. Obviously the United States is different because A, it's so big, B, it's got oceans on both sides, and C, we're the most powerful nation in the world. There's that. So again, framing is all hypothetical, but my guess is that the US or the UK or whatever, obviously, I guess that Wales and Scotland are part of the UK, but Great Britain, would have gone in a lot harder, than Israel did. I mean, Israel took 3 weeks to even go in just to make sure that the citizens were out of the way and that they could, go in a very, very mindful manner instead of just a reactive manner. And the reason this war is taking so long, and let me just remind people that the Russia-Ukraine war is in its third year, and I don't see anybody counting those days. But the precision and the care and obviously the hostages make this process in Gaza so much more drawn out. I'm not sure if like ripping the band-aid would have been better if they went in and just, destroyed Gaza in one day. I'm not, yes, Hamas might be gone, but I don't think that would have solved the problems. Are you frozen or just thinking? Frozen. Okay. Can you hear me? Yeah, I so Andrew, you're frozen. I don't know if it's worth it to jump off and jump back on. Boy. Live TV, guys. Okay, well, I guess that Andrew will be back. In the meantime, let me just give a little frame of reference about Andrew and what he's been doing this week. So on Wednesday, which seems like years ago now, but was actually just a few days ago, Andrew actually spoke on a panel at the United Nations with John Spencer, who did the very first Yoga of War podcast with me, Natasha Hausdorff, who did the second one, Colonel Richard Kemp, and also Alan Dershowitz. I'm sure you've heard of him. And they did a panel on proportionality at the United Nations. Now, I do want to add that Andrew, John Spencer, and Richard Kemp, all of them are neither Jewish nor Israeli. All of them are among the highest experts in urban warfare on Earth today, and all of them came to the same conclusions, which is that Israel has been acting within the rules of law and with proportionality. Now, I know that nobody here has logged on to listen to me talk, so hopefully Andrew will be back shortly. In the meantime, if you did not hear, I'm just gonna see if he's trying to contact me. He's logging back on. If you did not have the chance to see his hello, to see their panel at the United Nations, I will go ahead and make a link to that and put it in the show notes. Meanwhile, Andrew, welcome back.
Sorry
Glad
about that. Don't know
to see you. Our viewership just plummeted. They're like, oh God, Sean is talking again.
why.
Okay,
Sorry.
so I was just mentioning your panel on Wednesday. And before we get into the actual content, I do have a question because there's so many people at the United Nations who need to hear what you guys had to say on Wednesday. Can you tell me who was actually in the audience? Was it just an echo chamber or were there some surprising faces?
No, I think it was a very friendly audience who wanted to hear what we had to say rather than needed to hear it. And I don't think the actual content of the speech was as important as the fact it happened in the UN. There have been so few pro-Israeli voices heard in that building, and I think it was just a matter of putting a statement out to say that yes, we can talk in the UN as well, which I think is important.
Yeah. How was that organized? It was through the Raoul Wallenberg Institute, correct?
Yeah, I believe so.
And I don't even understand the dynamics. Like, are you invited by the UN? Are you using just like a room in the building? Do you rent it? Is it an official panel? Like, what?
Yeah, it was a room in the building, a really nice room. It was one of their prestige rooms, so it's stunning view over the river. The organization rented it. They invited the speakers, they invited the guests, and they organized a reception to go alongside it. And yeah, it happened during UN General Assembly week, which was the symbolism of the whole thing.
Well, the UN Generally Assembly Week is, I try to keep my language clean, not just because I'm a yoga instructor, but it is YouTube. So it's pretty much an anti-Israel circus show. It was a disgrace to listen to just leader after. I actually got a lot of chuckles out of listening to the Pakistani leader talking before Netanyahu yesterday, about peace, love, and happiness. No hypocrisy there at all. But let's talk about proportionality. Because of the simple definition of the word, people seem to think that proportionality means that the IDF should do exactly what Hamas did, same, same. End of the thing. Of course, that would involve, raping women, beheading babies, baking babies, killing children in front of their parents, parents in front of their children, kidnapping 251 people, massacring. So I think it's actually around 1600. So I know it was 1200 citizens, but I think there was about 3500 IDF and about 50 police, if I'm accurate on that. If proportionality literally meant same, same, A, that would be sick. And how are we going to execute that? No pun intended. But a war would never be won in that kind of circumstance. So can you make it clear to us what does proportionality actually mean in war and in the rules of war?
To explain it as simply as I can, it means that the anticipated damage for any attack has to be in proportion to the achievement of carrying out that military attack. So, for example, if you were attacking Sinwar, say they identified Sinwar, he didn't have any hostages around him, you could subjectively have a lot of damage to the surrounds by taking him out. And actually, perfect example is Nasrallah yesterday. If you
Exactly.
look. You know, if you look at how many buildings were leveled and how many 2,000-pound bombs were dropped, but you can say that's proportionate because although huge amounts of damage were caused, the target value was the head of Hezbollah. Now, if it was just a random gunman on the street, just a foot soldier, and you leveled half an apartment block or half a block, then you can make a case that wasn't proportionate. But it is, of course, entirely subjective depending on the
Right.
value you place on the target you're striking.
So there's a lot of game theory going on here, right? And also these I'll call it the economics of humanity, like whose life is the most important, whose life is the most strategic, what areas, are fair game, what areas aren't fair game. And of course, the way that Hezbollah and Hamas like set themselves up, it's in such a way that they deliberately, I mean, it's not an accident. They deliberately put all of their strategic assets in the middle of civilian areas, not only in order to draw the sympathy of the world when they're all destroyed, but also to ironically, to deter the IDF to some extent, because the IDF has morals. And civilian or whatever, human shields wouldn't even be a deterrent unless Israel didn't care about people. I mean, if Israel were to use a human shield strategy, as ludicrous as it sounds, Hamas, Lebanon, all the Iranian proxies would take full advantage of the situation and say they couldn't believe their luck.
Yeah, and it's, you know, to give you a small history lesson, this goes back to like St. Augustine, where he spoke about the just war theory and talked about, you know, justice in terms of going to war and then justice in terms of your conduct during the war. And what that means, I think, is the post 1945 rules of war that came up through the Geneva Conventions in 48 and the various other, you know, statutes that we've got in place to try and create some sort of structure around war and some rules around war are all heavily based around Judeo-Christian ethic.
Right.
And of course, if you run into the Arab world, they don't share that history. They don't share that morality that's developed over centuries in the West. It's they've got their own morality. It's very different. And they don't place the same kind of value on their own people that we would in the same situation. You know, they're quite happy to have a human sacrifice strategy in Gaza. And I don't like human shield because human shield implies you're trying to get the enemy not to fire. Actually, it's a human sacrifice strategy where they want Israel to open fire and they want civilian deaths so they can trumpet them to the world to say how bad Israel is. And that's been an incredibly effective strategy for them, and it has worked. And you can see that from the condemnation that they've received worldwide. And I think the most telling moment in the UN this week was delegates walking out when Mr. Netanyahu was speaking. They're quite happy to welcome the Palestinians who carried out the 7th of October massacre. And even though they don't agree with Mr. Netanyahu, even though they don't have to, it's not, you know, it's hopefully, you know, a democratic institution for the most part and that people can believe or agree with whomsoever they wish. But the point is, because they didn't agree with Mr. Netanyahu, they weren't even prepared to listen to the leader of the world's only Jewish state, but they were happy to welcome and upgrade the status of Palestine. Very, very telling from my perspective.
Sure. And in chat, boy, there's so much I want to say about this. The most recent saying, sympathy of the world is with Palestine and Lebanon. Two things I have to say to that. First of all, there is no Palestine. I say this, objectively speaking, you can't have a country without borders or a government. But I understand the concept. But before that, please address this because you just did, but somebody still wrote it. Proportionality doesn't allow for destruction of over 85% of buildings and a genocide. I have a lot to say about this, but this is all about your views on this. Please address this comment.
Well, apparently it does allow for just making stuff up because that's what's happened there. There's not that, that's not the number of buildings that have been destroyed, damaged potentially, but that means even one chip of paint knocked off. It's around 20% destroyed buildings, but there's a very good reason for that. And it's because Hamas have linked their underground infrastructure to every building in Gaza. And if you're going to take that apart, then unfortunately the stuff on the surface is going to get damaged as well. But that's proportionate, because that's in line with the objective of destroying those tunnels, which is an overarching military goal. So you can cause quite a lot of damage quite legally by taking the tunnels apart. And in terms of genocide, actually, I don't engage with that anymore. It's such patent nonsense that it's not worth my time to waste oxygen on discussing it. Nobody believes it's a genocide who has half a brain. Anyone that still thinks there is needs to go and get themselves re-educated, and it's not my job to do that. But I do charge about $500 an hour. If they want the education, they can email me. That's fine.
Okay, good to know. And one more question, and then I really have to let go of this because this is such a ridiculous line of questioning. And then we're going to get back to my questions. But I think that people need to understand how off base this line of questioning is. So last question from the chat, and then we're going to move on. Literally, is there any evidence of human shields besides the fact that the leaders themselves have said that they use them? What evidence do we have? Oh, and also that the whole entire tunnel system is built underneath the entire civilian infrastructure. If that is not smoking gun evidence, can you give me any evidence of a human shield?
I mean, you covered it pretty well, but there's some really good examples from just before the ground maneuver operation started. Videos of Hamas gunmen at gunpoint forcing people back into Gaza City who were trying to flee. There were IEDs planted on the road south to try and deter people from leaving. There's evidence of Hamas sending out messages to people saying, "Don't listen to the IDF, you don't have to leave." Trying to, corral people into their defensive positions so that they'd be there to deter. To deter IDF attacks. There's ample evidence of them using hospitals, ample evidence of them using mosques, ample evidence of them misusing ambulances as civilian cover. And really, I could talk for about an hour on this, but I think that's evidence enough. And as you say, they've actually said it. They've said it themselves. They've said we're happy to sacrifice every last civilian. Like, believe people when they tell you who they are. They've said this openly.
It is amazing. Ben Shapiro actually said it very, very succinctly in the beginning of all of this when he said, in the West, we have a particular narcissism that assumes that everybody shares the same values we do. And so by trying to superimpose our values on on a culture that really, really doesn't share them, it lends itself to a lot of denial. Another absurd manifestation of the same is the number of people who literally deny that 10/7 happened. But the problem is that the evidence was actually filmed by Hamas. They do not deny it. In fact, they're very, very happy about it. They're very proud about it. And so the ridiculousness of these denials, and also the continuation of this rhetoric. If what Israel is doing right now is genocide, then all war is genocide. Genocide is the deliberate annihilation of a particular person. Well, if you're in a war, a particular, sorry, like nationality or race or whatever, if you're in a war and you go into a country, everyone in that country is of a particular race. So yes, okay, fine. Then on its most basic level, then you could say all war is genocide. But beyond that, what's going on is absolutely and unequivocally not.
I think that's deliberate, though. I think that's a deliberate strategy on their part because they've looked at how we, i.e., Western countries, and I include Israel in that, they've looked at how we fight and they're trying to, they've understood that they can't defeat us toe to toe. I fought in Afghanistan. My first couple of tours, the Taliban would try and take us on in gunfights, lost every single one immediately. And so they switched to that strategy of IEDs and blowing us up outside our bases. The enemy at the moment have looked at how Israel fights and they've said, right, how do we negate that? And what they do is create a strategy where Israel can't fight because the international community is trying to tie their hands with ludicrous demands based on disinformation. And again, it's been a very effective strategy. As you said earlier, it slowed the war right down. This would have been over a lot sooner had Israel just been allowed to get on with the job. And I think it's actually, ironically, it's prolonged Palestinian suffering. By forcing Israel to slow down. If this had just been ripping off the band-aid and getting it over with, we could already be rebuilding Gaza with a new government. But as it is, we are where we are.
And Andrew, you served as rapporteur for the amicus brief, defending Israel at the ICC. Can I ask you, just on a personal level, like, why invest yourself in this super countercultural battle? And also, I'm always amazed at how much you engage yourself with the Twitter trolls. Like, you really have vested yourself in this fight. And why?
Just think it's the right thing to do. I have an unusual skill set in that I've got various degrees in law, war studies, psychology. I've got military experience myself, and it's now my job. I'm paid to learn about the Middle East and get involved with this stuff. And everything I've seen tells me that I have a decent level of analysis, and I think that Israel is behaving in a broadly moral and justified and legal manner. And it just, the disinformation blows my mind. up is down, left is right, black is white. It's just insanity. The fact we've still got people chirping up about genocide in your comments tells me all I need to know. I mean, nobody who knows anything about this conflict in any detail can realistically suggest this is a genocide. It doesn't tick any single genocide box in any way. I mean, hardly anyone is dying at the moment, and that's a good thing, frankly. But the point is, we're down into the low kind of double figures weekly. That's how little combat and how little killing is actually happening in Gaza at the moment. And I can't sit idly by and just let that insanity keep going. And I try to do. I mean, it does feel very much like shouting into a hurricane most of the time. But yeah, and I've been to Israel. I've met the IDF. I've met Israelis. I know the country not brilliantly well, but I know it well enough that I can make an assessment of kind of how people feel on the street. I talk to people. The idea of some sort of psychotic genocidal state is just ludicrous. And on top of that, I've got some very good Jewish friends in the UK, and this all started because I wanted to stand up for them in the face of a storm of anti-Semitism I was seeing. So that was the start point for being a public voice, I think, it was sticking up for Jewish people. But my opinions on Israel are now heard a bit more as a result, which I'm, grateful for.
And honestly, I could tell you, as being just heavily embedded in a lot of pro-Israel groups and groups that are fighting anti-Semitism around the world, how much appreciation there is for you, how much sharing of your tweets, and how important you've been to us as an ally, and how much that is appreciated. So can we talk a little bit about the validity of the United Nations, and also of like the ICC, the ICJ, because these are all bodies that have all but been hijacked by terrorist interests, or terrorist leaning or sympathizing or allying interests. I think that the problem is, as soon as anybody hears like UN, including like UNRWA or UNICEF, or if they the ICC, ICJ, this all, like, there's so much validity in the names, and quite honestly, there should be because of the overall membership. But when it comes to morality, all three of these, all three of these, I can't even enumerate them, are honestly farces of justice. Can you address that a little bit?
Again, I think it's a strategy. Our enemies are effectively using our own systems against us. They know that we'll abide by this stuff. They know we'll do that. And so if they can pervert that system to turn it against us, they know that we'll probably abide by it. Which is why it carries so much weight when you take farcical genocide cases to the ICJ, because that still carries credibility in the West. And the very fact that that case has been filed, never mind that it's nonsense and it's going to go nowhere, that doesn't matter. It's the very act of filing that lawfare that has that impact because of the credibility of these organizations in the West. And I think that is absolutely deliberate. And they know perfectly well what they're doing. And it's a sad end to the rules-based international order. I think it's this conflict in many ways has killed that stone dead, because what country could now go to war and listen to the ICJ when you know that you might get a farcical and made up genocide case filed against you, as you said earlier, just for going to war? So I think we're looking at the death throes of the international system at this present time.
So when you say it's going to go nowhere, to me that sounds like you think that Israel is going to get a fair shake. I don't think that's accurate.
Yeah, potentially, but they can't present. There's just no evidence to present. If you look at the case they put in that was ruled on in January, the preliminary ruling, it's all just stuff people have said on Twitter as an intent for genocide, and that's not how it works. And there's no case law to support that. So unless they can show some evidence of a worked up plan, which is what you need to prove intent in a genocide, I just don't see where it goes. And yes, the Ben-Gvirs and the Smotriches and their deeply unhelpful and silly comments in some cases have not been useful, I don't think. It's almost as if some of them are trying to lose that case single-handedly. But if we go back to the people who've actually made the decisions, Mr. Netanyahu, Mr. Gallant, there's nothing they've really said, once put in context, could possibly be considered intent for genocide. Even the famous quotes against Gallant that are used all the time are totally taken out of context or mistranslated or just didn't happen. The quote about a siege. There was no siege ever. There was a border with Egypt. You can't put somewhere under siege where you don't control the entire border. And actually, there was a brief pause in humanitarian aid for about 2 weeks. And the assessment was that Gaza would have enough supplies in there to last for that 2 week period. And ever since then, the aid has been flowing. So it makes no sense to me. I find it so bizarre that this has even got that far, but that's where we are with the corruption of the international system.
Exactly. And that's why I don't think that the cases will go nowhere. I don't think that justice in any way, I don't think there's any interest in justice when it comes to the Jewish state. I mean, there have been more Security Council resolutions against Israel, tiny little Israel, than every single nation on earth combined. I mean, like double. Like that in and of itself is. And that there's only one annual resolution. Well, there's a few of them, but that every year is on the permanent docket, and they are against the Jewish state. Period. Doesn't matter if there's a war, no war. Let's talk about the Jews. And so thank you so much for standing up for us. And when it comes to these war crimes, I mean, like for example, over 100. I mean, over. Sorry, over 1 million tons, well over 1 million tons of aid have been brought into Gaza, a large amount of which has not been distributed thanks to the inefficiencies of the UN, among other things. But to say that there's starvation, which is literally one of the charges that's being levied against Israel, when there's over 3,000 calories per person being driven into the Gaza Strip today. I mean, most people in the free world don't eat over 3,000 calories a day. In fact, that would be considered to be an unhealthy number of calories. So wherein everybody is talking about the starvation, including the President of the United States, including all media accounts, the vast chasm between reality and the fictions that are being created is so spectacular. How are the What did you see as far as aid? Did you meet with Kogat?
Yeah, I met Kogat, went to the Erez crossing, went to Kerem Shalom crossing, went to Gate 96. I've seen the roads that Israel built in Rafah. They built three roads in Rafah to enable the facilitation of aid from Kerem Shalom. Even when maneuver operations are going on 300 meters away, the aid is still flowing. So I've got no question that Israel's doing all it can to allow the ingress of aid. The distribution of aid is a different problem. Aid in a war zone is always challenging. There's a reason the four horsemen of the apocalypse is famine, death, pestilence, and war. They all go hand in hand with each other. You don't get war without the other three. And that's what Gaza is seeing. And I don't think it harms the case in any way to point out that life for an innocent person in Gaza right now is pretty unpleasant. I don't
100%.
think we can, I don't think we need to step away from that at all. It doesn't harm the case for Israel to say that and acknowledge that people are in a pretty sorry state, living in tents, with limited access to what they need to live an ordinary life. I mean, that must be horrendous, and the heart goes out to them. It is a tragic side effect of the fact that Hamas were running Gaza for however many years it was, what, 18 years, whatever, and have brought this war on their people's heads. Israel is not occupying the Gaza Strip other than the Netzarim corridor and the Philadelphia corridor. So they don't have a legal duty to distribute aid and take over that function. And if we're going to blame anyone for this, again, blame Hamas. They've been intercepting aid. They've been preventing aid from getting to people. They've been hijacking aid convoys. And they are still, legally speaking, the de facto government of the Gaza Strip. And they should have facilitated that aid to their people rather than steal it. So yes, there will be hungry people in Gaza. I have no question. 3,000 calories a day or no, distributing those 3,000 calories is challenging. Do I blame Israel for it? Not at all. And we go back to proportionality and we go back to just war. And the reason I don't blame Israel is because the reason for them going to war is just. And that goes right back to the early argument we had about what another country would do if 7th of October happened to them. No other country would do differently. It's a just war, and therefore the suffering is tragic and appalling, but unavoidable.
Exactly. And among the charges, like the wording is really that Israel is willfully causing this great suffering, serious injury to body or health, and killing. I really, from everything that I've read and from my conversation that I have with John Spencer, and also listening to Richard Kemp after all these years, because he's been in this conversation for at least a decade, is that there really is no it moral there is no more moral military on earth than the IDF. I mean, the IDF goes to such extraordinary lengths to get civilians out of harm's way, and they're fighting against really a genocidal enemy. If we want to use the word genocide, Hamas literally exists to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. That is their raison d'etre. They don't pretend it's anything else. Same with Hezbollah. So to say that Israel is willfully causing this suffering, and the suffering is traumatic for everybody to see, everybody. Every Jew, every Israeli, it's traumatic to watch what's going on in Gaza, but this war could have ended on day one had Hamas laid down its arms and returned the hostages. And these are all ongoing war crimes on Hamas's part.
Yeah, and they've been put into the ICC as well, but that was a real insult. It was a really calculated insult to put Hamas's leadership into the ICC at the same time as Israel's, and I think the prosecutor knew exactly what he was doing, and that to me suggests the entire process is flawed right from the offset. Even when we look at the evidence, and we can take apart their case with relative ease, actually. You need to look no further than the fact he did it all on the same day for both sides. It's, that gives you everything you need to know about his intent in doing this. I've sat with the IDF targeting cells. I've had a look at their process. First of all, I think the point to note is they're very much more technologically advanced than most other armies. I don't think even the Americans have the level of AI involvement that they do. But the really crucial point is they use AI to generate target packs and work out who to hit and when to hit. But then a human takes over. And that's really important. There have been some fairly bad bits of disinformation from 972 magazine pushed out about this, suggesting that AI is doing the whole targeting process, which is not true. But there are about six stages they have to jump through in a strike before they can drop anything. First of all, being looking at the intelligence, the second one being looking at civilian populations there. And they've got an incredible civilian harm mitigation cell, which is a technological marvel that no other army has, to assess the levels of civilian density in any particular area of Gaza. It's split into 120 cells. They can tell exactly who's in which cell at any one time. They then look at the rules of engagement. They then look at the correct warhead to choose. What size of bomb are they going to drop on this target? They do a collateral damage assessment. And then they do a final check for civilians, even soaking the target, as we call it, where you just keep an eye on the target for 24 hours before you actually drop, so you can work out pattern of life and who's in there and who's going in and out. And only then do they drop, and they can fail at that targeting process at any one stage. They've cancelled one in every two airstrikes in Gaza because of any one of those six phases failing. And that is absolutely analogous to what we do in the West, in British Army, in the American Army. We don't have some of the tools they've got. Certainly haven't got the AI. We certainly haven't got the civilian harm mitigation cell. But every other stage is completely comparable to what we do. And I've just seen nothing in my time with the IDF that suggests they're doing anything less than what we do. And in some cases, they're doing more.
Yeah, I think what's frightening and disturbing, particularly as a Jewish person, is watching all the leaders of the free world who are again, there are election and other, elements to consider, but that they are largely pandering to this anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, and quite honestly, anti-Western elements. And I'm just wondering, in your opinion, like, are Western values doomed to be like the biggest casualty of this war? I mean, I just see us going down a really dark and dangerous path.
I don't think so, because Israel is upholding those at this point, and I don't see any sign that our armies would ever slacken their standards
I'm not talking about military even. I'm talking about just the free world. If
Oh,
you look
society-wise,
at
yeah.
what's happening in the streets of Europe and the riots and like where is this all leading us? And we've got people literally now conflating destroying Israel with destroying America. We're seeing this all over our campuses. That's the newest, rhetoric is we actually want to take down this nation. So these are our next generation of leaders, and our current leadership is pandering to them. Where is this all headed?
I mean, it's still a minority. I don't know if you follow Azra Nomani. She's a Wall Street Journal investigative journalist. She's done some amazing work on these groups, digging into who's funding them, what they might be in court for in certain cases, and how many followers they've actually got. And for the size they are, they're making a disproportionate amount of noise. So that's the one reassuring thing, is that they're actually, some of the groups have only got 12 people yet, are making front page headlines because they're protesting the Democratic Convention. There is a bigger concern for me, and that is society's susceptibility to disinformation. And they've, Hamas and their allies have played a very clever game with this one, where they've created positions taken on emotion. So you see pictures of dead children and destroyed buildings, and people are rightly horrified. And if you don't have the knowledge to understand what you're seeing, if someone gives you an explanation, then you're happy to believe it. And I think that's where a lot of people falling for this genocide nonsense has come from. They've seen something appalling. Someone has then suggested that it's genocide, and they've leapt to that explanation as a kind of way of trying to understand the feelings of horror they're seeing, because what they're seeing is war. And when we have that kind of susceptibility to disinformation, it's very hard to rationalize people out of a position they've taken based on emotion. So it's all very well dropping in facts and figures and legal terms like proportionality, and making a legal case. But actually, if there's no rationality to deal with, then you can't persuade someone out of that position with rationality. So it's a really, really tricky one. And my bigger concern is that is a phenomenon we're going to see a lot more of as the future goes on. And we need to do something for our societal resilience, maybe in terms of education, training, or even regulation of social media platforms, to prevent these information campaigns having such a potent effect on our societal cohesion.
Sure, and I think that with everyone trying so hard to conflate calling for the genocide of all Jews with free speech, it's a rabbit hole that I don't want to run down, but it really is becoming hairy for social media, and obviously we've got whatever, Elon Musk, the free speech warrior, who, there's something to be said for both things, but the disinformation and the level of vitriol are very, very dangerous. And to that extent, let me just say that I really do believe that behind the scenes, America, for all intents and purposes, is militarily giving Israel more or less the support that it needs, but words mean something, and the way that they are constantly undermining Israel on the political and diplomatic fronts is extraordinarily damaging, not just theoretically, but honestly, that we live, I say as a yoga instructor, in this world of love and light, and I say this all the time, like no hate is okay in the world anymore. None. None. You can't hate on anybody for any reason except the Jews. And in fact, like even in the yoga community, it's like I'm inundated all day with like DEI rhetoric from Yoga Journal, from all Yoga Alliance, from all the things, right? And it's like we need to be more sensitive to this group, this group, this group, this group, this group. And yet, complete silence from the yoga hierarchy, which is supposed to be the epitome of kindness and acceptance when it comes to anti-Semitism. It's a discussion that nobody wants to touch, and that many in of the social justice warriors in my world are actually condoning anti-Semitism and blatant calls for genocide, no irony there, of the Jews, and calling it social justice. This is very, very troubling.
Yeah, and it's there's no easy answer, is there? That's the killer thing here. There's no, you can't put your finger on a silver bullet and say if we do this one thing, this will fix the problem. But we're just not doing it for some reason. There's no easy answer. I mean, this thing goes back millennia. You know, anti-Semitism is one of the world's oldest hatreds. Even if you read Shakespeare, you can see those anti-Semitic tropes pouring off the page. So, you're up against centuries, if not millennia, of challenges here, and I don't think there's an easy answer. And I don't really have huge amounts more to say than that, other than it's a matter for education, and it's a matter for holding a moral standard and calling it out when you see it. And I think that's all you can really do.
I don't want to take too much of your time. I mean, I do. I really want to take too much of your time, but can we just touch on Lebanon for 1 second? Because I mean, the last 2 weeks have really unfolded like a James Bond movie, and it's amazing to see. So now I just want to go into just one more definition. How many people are calling what Israel is doing terrorism, i.e. exploding the beepers of up to 4,000 known Hamas operatives. I mean, we can pretty much say with certainty that nobody on Earth today has a beeper unless nobody in Lebanon has a beeper unless you're with Hezbollah. That's not like a normal piece of equipment. These were as targeted an attack as it could possibly get. Of course, Nasrallah. What happened, leveling, it sounds like 6 buildings in order to get to Nasrallah and right, a whole room full of, strategic enemies, plus the whole Hezbollah hierarchy has basically been wiped out in 2 weeks. Then we've got that Israel has wiped out approximately 50% of their missile capability. And if you watch the videos of these strikes, they are amazing to behold, the secondary explosions that go on for, seconds, if not minutes, because these proving that these are very, very targeted attacks. And what do all of these things have in common is they're surgical nature. They are very, very directed attacks on very, very specific and legitimate war targets. And yet, once again, people across the world are equating this with terrorism. Can you clarify what is terrorism? And in the case of Israel, what is not terrorism?
I mean, terrorism is usually a sort of a violent act carried out to achieve the aim of terrorizing people. It's there to cause terror in local populations to achieve behavioral change so that you can achieve your political goals. Okay, and I don't think we can make any case that Israel's doing that. You can have state terrorism, and we've seen that with Russia and Ukraine. I think you can make a case that that's state terrorism, particularly the way they target deliberately civilian populations. In terms of proportionality for the pager thing, I mean, I think it's a tricky one. It's a really tricky one because you can't guarantee that everyone who's holding that pager at that moment is a Hezbollah terrorist, and you can't guarantee that nobody else is going to be caught up in the bang. I mean, they were quite small bangs, but you can't guarantee nobody else is going to get hurt by it. But you can say they're probably going to be the ones carrying the pages, and I think you can say that with a relative degree of knowledge, if particularly if you're the ones who've made and sold the pages to Hezbollah, particularly. So there's a whole chain of knowledge here where you can make some very, very accurate assumptions about who's going to get injured when these things go pop. And whilst proportionality is much harder to do than an airstrike, to suggest they're disproportionate, I don't think follows through because we've seen exactly who was hit by them, and we know who they were, and they were legitimate military targets. So I'm, yes, it's a bit more of a gray area than just an airstrike, but it's, to say that it's terrorism, I think it is silly. And actually, it's the sort of argument that doesn't really help the discussion at all because it's so hyperbolic that actually it's not a useful contribution to the debate. And yeah, of course, when we go talking about Nasrallah, we know the value of that target. And so the amount of collateral you can legally inflict on a target when the target is that high value is astronomical. And I don't think Israel have exceeded that at all. So I'm fairly relaxed about both sets of circumstances in terms of proportionality.
You use the word hyperbolic, which is amazing because I think we live in a very hyperbolic society right now. I don't think that anything is within proportion And so let me ask you sort of as the last question that I'm going to bring up. When we look at World War II and everybody looks at World War II, and I'm not even looking at it in terms of the Holocaust, just as far as it's the biggest, most recent war really that we've had on the international scale, that it ended with the bombings of Dresden, Nagasaki, Hiroshima. And, I actually talked to John Spencer about this, and he said that that probably, particularly Dresden, would not be considered might be considered a war crime today. Nonetheless, it did bring Nazi Germany to its knees and forced its surrender. So from that came a new world order, right? Japan and Germany are our allies today, and that would not have happened had the whole system not been dismantled. So I guess the question is, like, is that level of destruction the only possible path to victory, peace, and security? I mean, at what point will Iran and its proxies realize that this is not a fight worth fighting and that the Middle East would be so much stronger if it had Israeli tech and, military and intelligence and everything on its side instead of constantly fighting against it. So at what point, like, where does the dismantling and the effect of rebuilding come? When do we know that we've reached that pivot point?
Look, the whole international order post 1945 was set up to avoid any repeat of Dresden or Hiroshima being possible. So we've actually tried to put laws in place to stop that ever happening again. I think that's probably the first point to raise. To me, it currently feels a little bit like a 1950s solution to a 1930s problem, where war today doesn't look very much like war looked like in 1939 to 45. It's a lot more asymmetric. It's a lot more amongst the people. And it's very, very hard to carry out your military objectives without causing huge amounts of damage. And that's the problem Israel's running into in Gaza. And the reason they've been condemned is the level of damage, because people don't understand why it happened, or that it is legal to do what they've done. And where we go forward from this is a tricky one, because we know that our enemies are going to weaponize that 1948, post 1948 legislation against us. We know that our enemies are going to hide amongst civilians to try and minimize our ability to strike them. And we know that our enemies are going to, fight against us with a disinformation campaign where they lie about what we're trying to achieve. And, they spread sedition amongst our own populations about what our armed forces are doing when they deploy. So it's really tricky. And I think the ICJ case, I think, is it means that things like the ICJ can't be relied on in future. The ICC would have been a good idea. I don't think it is anymore. It's been weaponized and politicized. And so I think international law is in real trouble right now. I think it's in real trouble. I think its credibility has been undermined. I think the people who are supposed to enforce it and protect it are the ones who have done the most to destroy it. And that's worrying going forward, because whilst Western countries can broadly be trusted to behave, obviously every country has people serving in their militaries who will do bad things. That's just human nature, unfortunately. That's why there are laws to deal with it. But we will broadly try and stick to the rules. And there's a certain nihilistic jihadist enemy who that we know for a fact will not. And that makes life exceedingly difficult, and it makes wars much, much harder to win.
Yeah. So my last point I'd like to make is about the Abraham Accords, because ultimately, and we saw that obviously with Egypt, with Jordan, and now most recently with the Abraham Accords, that Israel is very happy and in fact very motivated by the prospects of peace and really will make peace with anybody who is willing to make peace with them. They've made that very clear. So there's this concept of creating peace from the outside instead of fighting, inside out, which would be war, to bring peace outside in. And obviously, all eyes are on Saudi Arabia now when it comes to the Abraham Accords. I mean, where do you think the tipping point is for peace? Like, how many people would, or people, how many countries would have to join the Abraham Accords in order for peace in coexistence to become the predominant narrative in the Middle East? Or is that really just pie in the sky? Is there any chance of peace in the Middle East?
I think that's the wrong question. I think what comes first is getting rid of Iran's influence. I think nothing happens peacewise in the Middle East while Iran are still have their aggressive proxy foreign policy. It's great that Hezbollah are getting deleted. It's great that they are, Iran's favorite proxy is getting taken off the battlefield. It still doesn't deal with the head of the snake. And I think until the head of the snake is dealt with, the Abraham Accords are going to be on freeze until that point happens. Because Saudi's in a tough position. Their fellow Muslims are getting killed legally or otherwise, depending on how we assign it, that they are getting killed. And that puts a bit of domestic pressure on certain Arab governments. Whilst that's happening, whilst that's ongoing, they can't really make political moves to get closer to Israel. I think it's telling that they've only condemned Israel in the mildest possible terms. They've said what they've had to say, but what they haven't done is gone full gangbusters to sort of throw the Israelis under a bus. So that in itself is telling. So the hope is there in the future. I think there's absolutely every chance that the Abraham Accords could go forward. And certainly, Mr. Netanyahu's dream of a pipeline of renewable energy from Saudi through to Israel through to Europe. I think that's a brilliant idea, and it's actually economic and diplomatic means that will bring long-term prosperity to the region. But none of that happens until Iran is dealt with, and that's a really tricky question as to where we go next once Hezbollah have been taken off the battlefield. How on earth do we deal with the rest of Iran's efforts?
Yeah, and I might just say that Israel has definitely proven, not just in the last 2 weeks, but really in the last few years, that they pretty much know everything. And in the dismantling of the Iranian nuclear infrastructure, as well as the potential of taking out oil reserves, which would have a detrimental effect, obviously, on particularly inflation across the world, but that is what originally brought Iran to the table with the nuclear talks, was disabling, I mean, not by actually destroying their oil fields, but by the sanctions that were put on them, that it brought them to their financial knees. And so, but when it comes to physically dismantling their financial infrastructure, just going in like what happened recently with the Houthis, how Israel came in and destroyed some of their oil fields, that maybe that would be, one way that the Iran would at some point have to come to the table of nations.
And perhaps Beirut gives us an example of what happens if not, something similar focused on their nuclear capability is certainly not outside the bounds of possibility now. And Iran will know that. And hopefully that will factor into their strategic calculus as to what they do next. But, they are religious fundamentalists. Logic doesn't always apply in such situations where jihad is the priority over human life. And so, my hopes are low. My hopes are low. I think we need to deal with Iran. I think it doesn't need to be Israel going it alone. I would happily see Western forces weighing in on their side when it comes to taking care of the regime in Iran, not only for the Middle East, not only for Israelis, not only for everyone with an interest in this part of the world, but for Iranians as well. They shouldn't have to live under that kind of a regime. And my hope for them for the future is that we find some way to topple the mullahs and cause as little damage to Iranian people as humanly possible.
And there definitely seems to be more and more evidence that the people of Iran would also love to see the overthrow of The Ayatollah. Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and wrap this up. I just want to ask you, Andrew, thank you. I always like to finish on a high note of hope, but I think the Abraham Accords, I mean, in whatever the realistic or non-realistic potential is for that, I mean, I just look back and say, you know what? Israel's biggest arms agreement is actually, oddly enough, not with America, it's with Germany right now. And whoever would have imagined that? And so, and again, like if you want to go way back, you know, and sometimes you have to go way back. Things can move like icebergs, you know, just even the UK-US alliance, you know, the war of, you know, independence did not leave Britain in a proud and you know, empowered space. And yet now we are complete and total allies. So I do think that there's hope. And is there anything else that you'd like to add before we sign off?
In terms of bringing hope to the situation,
Or
yeah,
anything.
I think there's hope for Lebanon from today, from this last 2 weeks. And let's not forget, as oppressed as the Iranian people are by the regime there, let's not forget the oppression that the Lebanese people have faced at the hands of Hezbollah. And hopefully their removal will lead to a much brighter future for that poor country that's been struggling for the last 20 plus years. And I really hope that as the West, we lean in and help them recover from the parasite that's just been cut free of their body politic. So I just want to sort of wish the best to the people of Lebanon, and I hope this is a step going forward for them, and it's going to be a really positive one.
Yeah, I mean, because Hezbollah, though they are part of the government by virtue of elections, Lebanon, for all intents and purposes, is still a democratic nation, and Hezbollah is not the ruling party. And hoping that the government of Lebanon does step up, extract once and for all Hezbollah from their society, restore Beirut to its, you know, early glories, and creates again peace with Israel. I think it could be possible. So, okay. Anything else?
No, that's good for me. I'm going to go walk my dogs. Thank you very
It's
much indeed.
Saturday. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time and with your insight, Andrew. I really, really appreciate your joining us. And Am Yisrael chai.
Yeah, ditto. Thank you for having me. I much appreciate it.